If you really want to do something, then you must work hard, take advantage of every opportunity, and if you don't give up, hopefully you find a way.
My name is Sebastian Krebitz, and today I have the great honor to speak with someone who truly embodies the spirit of this show, Dr. Jane Goodall. Welcome, Jane. Thank you so much for taking the time. It really means a lot.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
To kick things off, we have a little tradition on this show. Normally, in the studio, I'd offer you a glass of water or whiskey. So this one is virtual. What is it for you today? The strong sip of whiskey or the smooth glass of water?
Right now, it's too early for whiskey.
True.
I will stick with water and in this strange thing.
Oh, a nice cup. Love that. Honestly, I'm full of excitement and slightly nervous, so maybe a tiny splash of whiskey for the nerves, but I'll probably stick with water too today.
Actually, you know, in fact, whiskey is good for the voice. I've been using my voice so much that sometimes, even if it's 9 a.m, I have to have a wee sip of whiskey to tighten or loosen, whichever it's meant to be, the vocal cords.
Oh, I will cheers to that. Yeah, probably you're right. And fun fact, the whiskey in the podcast title is actually inspired by you. I heard you have this wonderful 7 p.m. ritual with a glass of whiskey. Would you share a bit more about that ritual with us?
When my mother was alive, her little tipple was whiskey because wine disagreed with her. She didn't like drinking water. So at 7 o'clock, you know, Mum and I would have a little sip of whiskey. And then when she died and her sister died and her brother died and my father died, all within about 8 months of each other, they were all over 90. And so I with my sister, we were having fun. I said, up there, there's this beautiful cloud with angels and harps. And I'm sure Mum's up there. And if there's any heavenly spirit, she will have a glass of it. So then we started raising our glasses to the people in the cloud, because so many people have said, can my mother be up there with yours? Can my brother be up there with yours? And so it's the cloud contingent we drink to at 7 o'clock every night.
Wow, that's such a beautiful habit. I can really picture it. And what about today at 7 p.m.? If you could share that whiskey with anyone, living or gone, who would it be and why?
Well, if it was living or gone, it would be my mother. She was so supportive when I was a child. When everybody laughed at my dream of going to Africa to live with wild animals and write books about them, she didn't. She just said, if you really want to do something like this, you're going to have to work really hard, take advantage of every opportunity, and if you don't give up, I'm sure you'll find a way.
Sounds like a wonderful person. Great choice. I think I'd raise my glass to my grandfather, who passed away 4 years ago, and he always encouraged me to write stories, especially the strange ones. And speaking of stories, one of my absolute favorites about you goes all the way back to when you were just 4 years old. You disappeared for hours, just to sit in a hen house. What happened that day? What do you remember?
Well, what I remember is partly what I've been told. Mum took me to stay on a farm in the country because we lived in London, not many animals there. And my job was to collect hen's eggs from the little hen houses. And apparently I began asking, well, where does the egg, where's the hole big enough for the egg to come out? Nobody told me. What I vividly remember is seeing a hen go into one of these little hen houses, I think there were 5 of them, where they slept at night, and thinking, she's going to lay an egg, crawling after her. And I can still feel her wing touching my face with squawks of, I suppose, fear. She flew out. So in my little 4-year-old brain, I must have thought, no hen will come in here to lay an egg. It's a frightening place. There's something horrid in there. So I went into an empty hen house and waited. I was gone for 4 whole hours and nobody knew where I was. But the patience, I finally saw a hen come in and I saw her lay an egg.
Wow.
And I don't know who was more excited, me or the hen. And anyway, when Mum saw this little girl rushing towards the house, all excited, a lot of mothers would have grabbed that child. How dare you go off without telling us? Don't you know how worried we've been? She saw my shining eyes and sat down to listen. And if you think about it, that's the making of a little scientist, asking questions, not getting an answer, deciding to find out for yourself, making a mistake, not giving up, and learning patience. It was all there in that four-year-old child, and a different mother might have crushed that excitement.
Totally true. And that story never fails to make me smile. I mean, I've never heard it that personal, so that is even more precious. And I have to say, I was a hen house kid too, so I can completely relate. I used to spend hours there. I just loved getting completely lost in this whole little chicken universe, you know. So thank you for sharing. And your mother's reaction was truly amazing.
Yeah,
I think it means so much when someone gives you space to be curious and dream big. As you said, that early support really helped shape the person you became, right?
Absolutely.
Let's fast forward to Gombe, 1960. You are 26, walking into the forest to study wild chimpanzees. But at first, the chimps would vanish the moment you got near. What helped you stay patient and keep trusting the process, even when the chimps kept their distance?
Well, I knew given time, I could gain their trust just as I'd waited hours in the garden to watch birds making their nests. And, you know, they allowed me to get closer and closer so that I could see all the details of what they were doing, how they were raising their chicks. And I would watch the squirrels. So the patience was demonstrated by waiting 4 hours in a hen house.
That's what I thought when I asked the question. Probably you learned it in the hen house. I remember just watching the documentary about the time in your life, and I was deeply struck by how calm and fearless and full of joy you seemed. That's so fascinating. For me, your experience there shows that sometimes the most incredible things happen when we are simply patient, as you said, and present. So, but after weeks of watching from a distance, one chimp finally let you get close. And instead of following a scientific protocol, you followed your instincts and gave him a name. The now famous David Greybeard. Right. Oh, you have a picture.
Yes.
Wow.
It's a painting, but it's absolutely perfect.
Very cool painting. Yeah. Wow. So you gave them names instead of numbers and connected with the chimps through empathy, way before science was ready for that kind of approach. What did you observe, and why was that kind of empathy such an important part of it?
Well, the main thing was I needed to get the chimpanzees' trust, because only when I could get close without worrying them could I hope to see normal behavior. And, you know, this empathy business. When I'd been with the chimpanzees 2 years, I got to Cambridge University because my sponsor, Lewis Leakey, made me. I hadn't been to college at all. And I was told by these erudite professors I'd done everything wrong. I shouldn't have named the chimps scientific to give them numbers. You can't talk about them having personalities, minds, or emotions. Why? Those are unique to us. But I had a wonderful teacher when I was a child who taught me that professors were talking rubbish. And that was my dog, Rusty. You can't share your life with a dog or a cat or whatever and not know that we're not the only beings who are sentient. And why is empathy important? Again, I was told, as a scientist, you can't show empathy towards your subject. You've got to be objective, and you can't have empathy if you're being objective. And that's not true. It's just simply not true. You can have really strong feelings of beings, happy for or sad for an animal you're watching, but your notes can be as precise can be. The whole thing is, because the chimps are so like us biologically, you know, we share 98.7% of our DNA with them, science gradually had to change. So detailed observation, photos, films, I didn't fight the science when they told me that, but gradually they changed themselves. They had to. And so that opened the door for all the rest of the animals, because back in the 60s, it was honestly thought by Western science there was a sharp line, humans here and all the rest over there. And because of the chimps, that line was broken. And now we study all those things in even insects.
Crazy. But of course, back then, that was revolutionary. Yeah. And I think what still moves so many of us about that time is exactly that. You didn't just study them, you saw them as individuals. It's incredible how empathy changed the way we relate to everything, to animals, to people, even to ourselves. But has empathy ever made things harder for you? I mean, emotionally, especially when witnessing all this suffering and destruction?
Oh, empathy, it can be terrible. I mean, yeah. You know, when you have to watch or hear about suffering and you can't really do anything about it, you know, it's the most awful, awful feeling. I can't sleep at night because of what's going on in Gaza and Sudan. And there's so many other things, the cruelty to animals in factory farms, billions of animals basically in concentration camps and puppy mills and, you know, breeding dogs for research and racing horses in a very cruel way. It's all horrible.
Thank you for being so honest about that. I think that's exactly the point. People often forget that empathy comes with a cost. On the other side, it also makes things meaningful. Is there a touching moment with a chimpanzee in Gombe that still makes you smile, especially on those tough days?
They're quite funny sometimes. There's a lot of fun stories, like young 7-year-old Freud, young male, and the chimps love to eat safari ants, we call them. They bite, they're a real biting thing, and they nest under the ground. So the chimp will very quickly scratch where the nest is, and then there's a long stick, which must be nice and smooth, push it down into the nest and quickly bring it up and eat the ants, but they start biting. So a session seldom lasts more than 2 minutes because the chimps are being bitten. So young Freud, oh, so smart, he found a vine which was stretched between two trees above the nest. So he gets a very long stick and he's up there and there's no ants anywhere near him. And so he's happily fishing away. And what happens? The vine breaks and he lands right in the nest.
Oh, no, the poor thing.
He cried and cried for about 10 minutes as he picked the ants off.
I hope the ants before tasted really good, so it was worth it.
Absolutely.
Incredible memory.
There's many of them.
I imagine, but I will keep that one close. Let's talk about a major turning point in your story. In 1986, you attended a conference in Chicago about the ethical treatment of animals. And from what I understand, it changed everything for you. What happened at that conference and how did it shape the path you've taken since?
Well, there was a conference that I helped put together. You know, when I began, it was just me. By 1986, there were six other sites where scientists were studying chimps. So what a great idea to bring the researchers together and ask, you know, does chimp behavior change according to the environment? Is there something like culture, which there is? We now know in lots of animals, but back then, you know, culture in animals, that's unique to humans, same thing. Anyway, we also had a session on conservation, session on conditions in some captive situations. And seeing chimpanzees, our closest relatives, in cages 5 foot by 5 foot, 7 foot high, bars above, bars on all sides, even bars on the ground, on the floor. And all the contact they had was people in white coats coming to stick them with needles to do some kind of protocol. And chimps can live for 60 or even 70 years. And some of them had been in these conditions for at least 30 years. And I got into the labs to actually see them later, that was. But still at the conference, the session on conservation, everywhere chimps were studied, their forests were being destroyed and chimp numbers were dropping. So I went to the conference as a scientist. I had my PhD by then, and I left as an activist. People say it must have been a tough decision, but I don't remember deciding. It was just I went as one and left as another. The reason I never wanted to be a scientist, I wanted to be a naturalist. And this empathy comes into it, I suppose, both in the wild and in captivity. But I knew I had to try to help, even though I didn't know what to do.
But I guess many in your position might have said, I'm a scientist, not an activist.
You know, the other thing is, when I was growing up wanting to go and live with wild animals, I never thought of being a scientist because women weren't back then. But I wanted to write books. And the first time I wrote a popular book, I was at Cambridge and I nearly got thrown out because scientists don't write popular books. I said, but every word in this book is true, at least as I understand it. It's no different from a scientific paper, except that that will be full of jargon that ordinary people can't understand. It makes scientists feel special, I suppose. I vowed never to use any of that scientific jargon, and I didn't.
Thank you so much for saying that, because I used to study biology too, and my professors always said, this is like a book, not like a scientific document. And so, yeah, it really helps to hear that. And it's incredibly powerful to hear how you trusted your inner compass, and even more powerful that you acted on it. And that brings me to something we talk about a lot on this show. Hope and the power of taking action. You have shown the world that even one voice can spark real change. But you have also shown that lasting change takes community. Why is Jane Goodall Institute Austria a great place to start for people who want to help? And what can people expect when they decide to be part of that movement?
Well, we now have 25 chapters of the Jane Goodall Institute around the world. Each one has the same mission, to make the world a better place for people, animals, and environment. So we have programs in Africa, conservation programs, and it hit me way back in the late 1980s, when I flew over to visit those chimp sites that I talked about, to try and learn more about what was happening to the chimps. And yes, I learned a lot. You know, their forests are going and they're being caught for bushmeat. But I also learned about the number of communities living in and around chimp habitat who were cripplingly poor. They didn't have good health or education facilities, sometimes no facilities. And their numbers were growing and the land was getting overused. And flying over tiny Gombe National Park, where we're still studying chimps, 65 years now. And when I began in 60, it was part of a great forest belt that stretched across Africa. By the late 1980s, I looked down from a small plane and was shocked to see the park was forested, but all round it, where there was thick forest, now there were bare hills. And that's when it hit me. If we can't help these people find ways of living other than destroying the environment to get money from charcoal or timber or more land to grow more food to sell, then we can't save chimps, forests, or anything else. So our programs in all JGIs who can afford to make donations is to carry on with the research, not only in Gombe, but 5 other research sites where JGI is working to improve the lives of the people living in and around these areas in a program we call Takari, which is a true community-led conservation program. Then we rescue infant chimps whose mothers have been shot for bushmeat or shot so that babies can be stolen for the illegal wildlife trade. So we have 2 main sanctuaries, one the biggest in Africa, for caring for these orphan chimps. And then finally, we have our program for young people of all ages, kindergarten through university. Each group has us saying that every one of us makes an impact every day, and we can choose what sort of impact to make. And they all do three projects. Not every child has to do all three, but the group as a whole. One to help people, one to help animals, one to help the environment, because everything is interconnected, as I learned in the forest. Oh, and we also have a program called Chimpanzoo, which is improving conditions in zoos. Students can observe the chimps and learn about them, well, just for helping them better understand animals.
I think that's very crucial. I know you have said it probably many, many times, but I'd love to hear it once more in your own words. What does hope mean to you?
Well, hope to me is not wishful thinking. It's taking action. And I've had many people come to me totally depressed. They look around the world, they see the doom and the gloom, which the media is full of. And they just say, well, I'm one person, I can't make a difference. So they give up, they become apathetic. And so I say to them, well, you can't change the world, of course you can't. But what about in your own community? Is there something wrong there that maybe you could do something about? Like, are the streets littered? Is garbage flowing into the river? What about street children? Or are there refugees you could help? All those sort of questions. Go and do it. Get friends to help you. And then you'll find you are making a difference. And then you want to do more because it makes you feel good. And then, especially if it's JGI or Roots and Shoots, think there are other people doing this around the world. Because Roots and Shoots is now in 75 countries. So the young people, they know that what they're doing is being done in 74 other countries.
Wow. As you mentioned, Roots and Shoots empowers young people to make change in their own communities. Can you share a story from the program that really sticks with you?
Well, there's one. It's perhaps not an example that you're thinking of. I mean, they do so many things. They plant trees. They do vegetable gardens. They make butterfly gardens. They raise money for all kinds of different issues. But the story that I love, because to me it's very symbolic, was the first group to be formed in DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And they were kids of about 8 to 10. And they decided for their first project, they wanted to put trees back on that hill over there that used to be a sacred hill, and now most of the trees have gone. So their mentor, he thought, well, actually, they can't do that, but he didn't want to dampen their enthusiasm. So he got a forester friend to give him saplings. There were 15 kids. And then he had, this is the part where the minerals are, where all the fighting is. And so there was always one group after another of militia. So we had to go and talk to the commander for permission. So the guy said, well, it seems stupid, but harmless. But I'm sorry, you'll have to have soldiers with you. So you imagine 15 little kids carrying their little saplings, and I suppose something to dig with, and four big Congolese soldiers with AK-47 over their shoulder. Indeed, the hill's further away than they thought. And when they get there, the ground is very hard. And the youngest little child starts to cry because it's so hard, she can't dig a hole to put her tree in. And after about 10 minutes, one of the soldiers leans his gun against the tree and goes to help her. And within the next 10, 15 minutes, all the soldiers had left their guns and were helping to plant trees for the future.
I really can picture that. It's really moving.
It's my favorite story. It's, you know, it's not the most inspiring as to what the children are doing, but it's so symbolic of Roots and Shoots, because what are we fighting now? Terrible war.
You see it in your mind, and you see how they lay down their guns. And as you said, it's so symbolic.
Yeah, you have empathy again. The soldiers had empathy for the children. You see, my dream for Roots and Shoots is we're growing caring, compassionate, responsible citizens of the future who will get into decision making. And in fact, some already are, and they maintain those values of respect and compassion. Courage to stick up for what you believe in.
I hope that too. And before we wrap things up, I've heard in another podcast, you said the question people don't ask you enough is, what happens when I die? So Jane, if you're open to it, I'm very curious, I have to say. How would you answer that?
Well, it cropped up because a woman in a large audience, I think it was in Canada, and she asked me what would be my next adventure. So I'd never been asked that before. So I thought, you know, 20 years ago, I would have said, I want to go to Papua New Guinea because they're finding all these new species and it's so beautiful and untouched. But I can't do that now. So I thought, and I said, well, dying. And there was a silence. And I said, well, when we die, there's either nothing, fine, or there's something. And I happen to believe there is something. I happen to believe this life is not the end of us, that something like consciousness will continue. So I can't think of a more exciting adventure than finding out what that something is.
I think it's rare to talk about death in such a calm and open way. And I feel the same way. I have to admit, I have always had a soft spot for this afterlife. And I also think there is something afterwards.
Well, all the books written, and some of them by, you know, scientists, one by a neuroscientist called Proof of Heaven. These are them describing what happened to them when they had a near-death experience. And, you know, I've had experience myself of somebody who's died who I could swear was there in the room talking to me.
I had some of this experience too, so I'm a strong believer. I totally get what you say. I also do have a follow-up question. If someone walks into Jane Goodall Institute decades after you're gone, what would you hope they see or hear or maybe feel?
I would hope that the main mission of trying to make the world a better place for everything would still be going on, and that and I truly believe that there will be Roots and Shoots and JGI which are carrying on in much the same way. I hope there'll be more JGIs, and I hope Roots and Shoots will be in many, many, many more schools.
I think people will always feel your presence there somehow. I truly believe that, because I also believe in the afterlife, so maybe that's the reason why. And one last thing. We are collecting quotes from all our guests. We call it our Be Jane Tapestry of Hope. May I ask you for one thought or piece of wisdom you'd like to share?
My mother's advice: if you really want to do something, then you must work hard, take advantage of every opportunity, and if you don't give up, hopefully you find a way. Because that's a quote I share with young people as I'm traveling around the world.
I believe this is the perfect way to end this conversation. Jane, once more, thank you for your voice, your fire, your humor, and your heart. This conversation is something I will never forget, especially my hen house kid version of me.
Thank you for inviting me, and I've enjoyed our conversation too.